Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diofen Heskey.
Welcome back. Now, Damien Delaney is on the line. Evening.
Oh, how are you keeping?
Yeah, very well. Look, I think truth being truth, if your ears were burning, I was bemoaning your decision just before the ad break to pick Galway ahead of Stephen Cluxton. I feel I should say that to your face.
I had to, man. I wouldn't be able to show my face down in Cork again if I didn't.
Why? Because of anti-Dublin stuff?
Well, Cork GA is in a bad place at the minute, you know. I can't be. You've had enough success anyway, so leave the begrudging Cork fellas alone.
Okay, well, you begrudge away. I'm not a dub, by the way. Let's put that on the record as well.
Go on, so why does that upset you so?
Well, Cluxton's moment for me, if you were to say Dublin over the last decade, that is the iconic moment. That is beating Kerry to win a First All-Ireland in however long. The pressure on him, the build-up to it as he runs up to take the kick. What it meant for Dublin GAA, what it propelled them into doing. Yeah. Versus Galway winning a one-off All-Ireland with a very likeable and brilliant team. But in 20 years, put it this way, in 20 years, everybody will still remember Cluxton's moment and it will still be talked about. And I feel that will be less the case with Galway winning a hurling All-Ireland.
I think that with the resources that Galway had available to them, the proximity to the capital, the fact that Dublin get to play all the games at Croke Park, they always have the hill, it's not iconic for me. I'm sorry, Shane Lowry beating all the odds, the weather, the field, everything about Galway is just so much better, to be honest with you. That's how I genuinely feel.
But it was when Cluxton kicked it. I mean, they hadn't won 10 in a row at that stage. This was can you imagine the psychological barrier that was there for Dublin, the pressure on him in that moment?
Yeah, I mean, look, I respect people like Chris Froome as well, but when they have the biggest, you know, they have a big budget, they're backed by AIG, they get the capital, it's all stacked in their favour. That's just how I feel about it. So it's not iconic. It's a fantastic moment, but it's not iconic.
Wow.
We're
going to have to really agree to disagree here. So, Carlo Ancelotti or Mikel Arteta, who would strike you as the better manager here if that's how business transpires?
They're both not kind of jobs you'd be jumping at, I'll be honest with you. And Mikel Arteta, I know he's been at Arsenal. Maybe he has a better understanding of the club. But they're not ideal scenarios for either. Mm. There's a lot of pitfalls for both of them. If Arteta does go to Arsenal, at least he's been at the club, so he has some idea of what they're about. Mm. Ancelotti going into Everton, I mean, it's not a fantastic squad. You've got an owner, you've got Bill Kenwright somehow still involved there, you've got Marcel Brands, I think his name is, still in there as well. It's just not an ideal situation for anyone. Now, I know Everton have money, and they have the potential to spend money, but look, it's a bit of a pitfall for both of them, but I wish both of them luck if they do end up taking those jobs.
The interesting thing about Ancelotti over the last couple of years is that he has firmly established his reputation as a facilitator, as a manager of big players and big egos, and we saw the job he did at Chelsea. That's not Everton, quite clearly.
No, but perhaps it's the lure of the Premier League. And perhaps after meeting the owner, who has money by all accounts, has spent money, has probably promised to spend money again. As we've seen with Napoli in the Champions League this season, he can definitely set up the team to defend. And I think that's obviously Everton's biggest problem this year, is they ship an awful lot of goals. Mm. So he's going to go in there, stop the rot, so to speak. Although I know Duncan Ferguson has gone a long way to doing that as well. But he's going to set them up strong defensively, and hopefully if he can get a couple of players in January, Everton would definitely pull away from that relegation zone.
The Duncan Ferguson tenure has been interesting. It's only been two games, but he's made an impact, that's for sure. And on the pitch yesterday, in his shirt, being interviewed by Jeff Shreeves live on TV. I must say, before the Ancelotti news really firmed up this afternoon, I was looking at Duncan Ferguson thinking, he's saying he doesn't want the job, but he is absolutely behaving like a man who wants to be front and centre. I wasn't so sure of the dynamics.
Yeah, I think it's hard for him to go there and say he wants a job when in his heart of hearts he knows he's not going to get it. Mm. I think Duncan Ferguson is a very emotional guy, and he's brought a lot of emotion, a lot of charisma to the job. I think it's probably something that Everton fans want to see, because, you know, supporters want to see a manager that genuinely feels for the club. And I think he's given them that. But in the long run, you know, when you look at the decision he made on Saturday about Moise Keane, bringing him on and taking him off, I mean, they're not the traits of an experienced manager. If you're bringing a player on, and I know, listen, fans from the outside will say, oh, well, if he wasn't doing his job. But if you look at what Moise Keane's performance on merit of what it was, he didn't deserve to be taken off. I mean, he wasn't fantastic. But if that's where Duncan Ferguson is setting the bar, well, then he's going to run out of substitutions in the first 20 minutes of every game. So from that point of view, which means he's still an emotional guy, I would say safely that that substitution was a lot more than just his performance. You know, I'd say Duncan Ferguson genuinely dislikes the guy. I've heard or read things that his, you know, he's regularly late for training, doesn't train very well. He probably epitomises everything about modern football. A young kid at Juventus, sees a big money move, probably in the best of professionals, and he's probably kind of anti-football, really, or kind of the anti-Duncan Ferguson. So, but you can't go down that road with him. If he doesn't like him, then he shouldn't have brought him on. If he didn't think he was going to get a performance out of him, then he shouldn't have brought him on. He should have just left him on the bench and brought somebody else on. So they're not the traits of a manager, an experienced manager that's managing off logic and not emotion. You know, that emotion will only get you so far.
Because the mood music around Moise Keane isn't good generally. Like, just a couple of weeks ago, his father was talking about the transfer. He said, sending my son to England was a mistake. He's still so young. He's not feeling good at Everton. I don't like this transfer. I hope he can go back to Italy as soon as possible. I hope he goes to Rome. But the important thing is he comes back here. So clearly it's not working out. Even behind the scenes, it's not working out there at all. The mistake really seems to be putting him on in the first place. Like, I would presume Ferguson would have a feel for Moise Keane's temperament, what he can offer, where he is in his career. He would have other options. Should you, when you put him on and you think to yourself, oh, I've made a mistake here, my worries about this guy are now manifesting themselves on the pitch, do you have any kind of duty to the player, especially when he's that young, to say, well, I'm just going to leave him out there even though it's bad for the team, or do you have to put the team first?
But he knows all these things about him and he still put him on. You know, if he understood that the guy is like this, he doesn't train well, he's not reliable, then don't put him on.
But once you do, do you have a duty of care to the individual?
No, because if you put a guy on and you're taking him off after 18 minutes, he better be absolutely stinking the place out. Yeah. And I mean, he better be awful, beyond belief, in so far as it's one of those days where he just can't get himself together, or he's genuinely just like, you know, his temperament or his demeanour is showing, I don't want to be here. Why did you bother putting me on? I want to go back to Italy. And I don't think he showed either of those things. I'm not by any stretch of imagination saying he played well. He didn't. He gave away a couple of free kicks. Maybe he looked like he didn't understand what he was told and was going on. Because I actually went back and I watched the highlights. The last 20 minutes, because I was interested in myself. And I just watched him. And Duncan Ferguson is shouting at him from the touchline the minute he got on the pitch.
Okay.
So that either tells me that Duncan Ferguson is either really, really upset with him, or he hasn't given him the instructions, or there's been a breakdown somewhere, because Moise Keane is clearly not giving Duncan Ferguson what he wants, or he's not doing what he's been told to do. No, you can say that's the player's fault, or that's the manager's fault. If the manager didn't get his point across, then that's his fault. So if you put a player on and he's not crystal clear of what you want from him, because he wasn't that bad. He ran around, not amazingly so, but he ran around. Yeah, he gave away a couple of free kicks and whatnot, but he genuinely looked like he went on and he stood in the middle of the park. And at one point, he's screaming at him, and he runs past Calvert-Lewin, who's playing on the right, and it just looked very mixed up. And I think that's more of a reflection on the manager as well, if I'm being honest with you. But that's what happens when Duncan Ferguson isn't a manager. You know, he's not an experienced manager. So without looking, you know, knowing what's going on behind the scenes, it's difficult to say. What it looked like for me is that he went on and he didn't know his job.
Yeah. Funny, the only manager it reminded me of as someone who might pull a similar stunt was Jose.
I've seen it done before. I've seen it done loads of times before. But generally, when it happens, you know, as a teammate, if the player deserved it, like he came on and he was absolutely terrible. He didn't try at all. He basically just tossed the game off and said, "Look, I don't really care anymore." Then you can justify it. But if you do that to a player and he's not been playing that bad, it sends out a funny message to the squad, and you're going to get caught sooner or later. And that's why he isn't experienced enough. He doesn't have the temperament. Yes, he's got passion and emotion, but he hasn't got logic, because managers need to manage on logic, not emotion. You know?
Yeah, no, it's true. I think maybe what Jose might have done was say something to the player as he was bringing him off, whereas Ferguson sort of ignored him a little bit, which compounded the whole feel of the situation. And then he tried to kind of lie initially about why he'd taken him off. He said, oh, no, it was nothing to do with Keane. It was just I needed to get somebody on. you know.
Yeah.
Later on he admitted, well, okay, look, Keane didn't get to the pitch of the game. Like, I mean, it was obvious to everyone that you hadn't just randomly picked the guy to take off.
Well, Jose took off Eric Dier in one of his first games.
The Champions League, yeah.
And everyone was kind of saying, oh, well, that's the end of Eric Dier. But there was logic in what Jose did. Mm. You could see straight away as why he took him off. They were losing a game 2-0. He needed to get back in the game. He didn't need a defensive midfield player. And afterwards, he explained it. And everyone went, yeah, that seems reasonable.
Yeah.
Whereas Duncan Ferguson ignored him when he was coming off and then kind of got in a muddle saying, I need to get some fresh legs on the pitch. Well, he's only been on 18 minutes. So, I mean, he's not tired out. So, you know, it's decisions like that as to why I don't think he obviously isn't going to get the job, you know.
Yeah. So you said you had a look back at the game again, even to see about Keane's performance. What about Manchester United then, who are fairly firmly entrenched of this beating the bigger sides versus slipping up against sides who don't really come out and play all that much? Like, Seamus Coleman made the point afterwards. He was talking to Stephen Doyle here, who was on commentary, and he was saying, like, from Everton's point of view, they didn't see it as a day for fullbacks getting ahead of the ball. And if you develop that a bit further, the implication is, well, against Manchester United, if we sit back and keep things reasonably solid, they're not at a point where they can cut teams open yet. They can get itch on the break, obviously, but less so against lesser teams. They're coming unstuck in that department routinely now.
Yeah, they're lacking a real quality from midfield, a player that can pick a pass or a player that can do something special. I mean, they're a good side. They're diligent. They're workmanlike. A lot of young players feeling their way in, learning the game, learning how to win games like Everton yesterday, as opposed to playing in, like, you know, Europe, where they may not necessarily have most of the possession, they counter-attack. But that's up to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to get the players in that he wants. Mm. But to be talking about Man United in this breath is crazy, really, when you look at the amount of money they have spent and you look at the squad that they're left with. Mm. Because it's not as if they tighten the purse strings after Alex Ferguson. I mean, they've spent upwards of 800 million, I think, since Ferguson had left, something in that ballpark. And to see some of the young players that are on there, I mean, the waste of money is just, you know, it's criminal, basically.
Mm. Is that a difficult thing to coach? You know, I'm not saying Everton parked the bus, but I'm just talking generally here. Because you often see frustrated managers saying, well, look, like, there was no space, the opposition parked the bus, we couldn't make a breakthrough. It would strike me as just by physics, you know. It is the toughest thing to imbue a team with the ability to do. I'm sure with Palace you found yourself sitting in against really good teams and been able to withstand it. So, like, is that something you'd be looking at Solskjaer saying, well, you need to coach this team how to break down 10 men behind the ball? Is that possible to coach?
Oh, 100%. Well, question, you know, and there's lots of things that can feed into that, you know, switching the play. Because, you know, sometimes a lot of teams will get all 11 players over in one half of the pitch. And when I talk about half the pitch, I'm thinking if you draw a line from the penalty spot to the penalty spot, when you're playing that compact, narrow, you know, your opposite fullback will be on the penalty spot. You're right. So you've all 11 players in one half of the pitch, that side of it. So the switch of play is what will get you quickly, because when the ball gets switched and when that team that's been defending on that side is getting across, you get like the concertina effect, you know, where one player will move more quickly than the other and little gaps will slightly appear. And then when it gets switched away, you come back in the middle. And when you come back in the middle, that's how you break it up. Whereas if you're slow and players are taking two or three touches, it's very easy to get into your shape. And you look to your left, you look to your right, you look in front and you look behind you if you're a midfield player, and no one's going to be more than 10 yards away from you. So there's no gaps to get through. What kills you or what gets you through that is playing one and two touch and switching the play and continuously switching it. Not just switching it and staying on one side, switching it back again, because that's how you widen that, because that's how you want your gaps to appear. You need to widen those two banks of four so you can get through it. And Manchester United just move the ball too slowly. They seem intent on kind of, if they're attacking down one side, they seem to stay down that one side.
Yeah.
Whereas you've got to switch it very, very quickly in one, if not two passes maximum, and then switch it back again. And eventually one player will switch off and not kind of get across like you're supposed to, and that's when the good players will find that gap in your armory.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Whereas with what Manchester United are doing, if you and your Crystal Palace team a couple of years ago were there, everyone's comfortable, you're all talking to each other, it's all in front of you.
Yeah, there's never any big gaps, and you know that if you do get caught a little bit, you know there's someone only 10 yards away, so you'll get dug out. You know, and I think that's what, you know, the top teams, Manchester City, do when they're caught, when teams sit in and digging against them, they just keep switching it. even if there's a pass on, they won't play it until they're 100% sure the gap is there. They'll just keep switching it. And it's basically like a, you know, like a cat playing with a ball of wool, you know. Mm. They're just waiting, you know, they're having fun with you, and then all of a sudden somebody switches off and then they go through you and they get you. So that's how you do that. But that's how you coach when you play against those types of systems. That's the best way to beat it. But Man United, just very slow, and they've young players as well, and they've not got players that are of the technical level of a David Silva or, you know, Kevin De Bruyne, that can, you know, hit a one-touch switch, you know, 40 yards across the pitch to Benjamin Mendy, who then come back in field to David Silva. Yes. You know, they have not those types of players, you know. That's just not how they operate right now. But they're, you know, Solskjaer's doing a reasonable job. I still don't think he's a man that's going to get Manchester United competitive again. I think Man United are going to be playing UEFA Cup, because Solskjaer doesn't have that ruthless streak in him, you know, to really... They don't look a well-coached team, United. They're okay, don't get me wrong. You know, they have good players, but they're not... I've watched them several times. There's nothing about them where you pick out one trait that they have and go, oh, my God, they're really good at that. You know, there's just nothing amazing about them, you know?
Yeah, or kind of sophisticated from a coaching point of view.
Yeah, I mean, you watch and there's no patterns developed when you watch them play. You know, they've got good players, yeah. And they go and play. And sometimes they win, sometimes they lose, sometimes they draw. And that's just where they are right now, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's probably the reality. One last brief tangent on that, because it's very interesting to get your perspective on playing against teams when you're sat in and you're set, and the teams who can break it down as opposed to the teams who can't. Because it is really striking, even when you're watching on TV, say a Man City facing a team with 10 men behind the ball. Mm. And as you said, they're like a cat playing with a ball or a half-dead mouse or whatever metaphor you want to use. Even when they're not making inroads, even when they're not pulling players out, there's just this sense that they're in control of the dynamics. Yeah. They're in control. Whereas you watch Manchester United against a team sitting back, it never feels like United are in control of the dynamics.
Yeah. There's definitely, when you watch United, an element of panic. You know, if they've got someone pinned in and they've had 15, 20 passes, the next fella that gets the ball thinks, oh my God, we're not doing anything, we're not going anywhere, and they'll try something very, very difficult. One of the best traits of the top teams, you know, Man City's, you know, Chelsea's, is they have their principles, they have their beliefs, and if you're drawing 0-0, which I have been before against these big teams, they will not come away from their beliefs. They will just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. Their patterns, they'll keep going. 91st, 92nd minute, they don't panic, they don't force it, they don't try something they shouldn't try, because they believe in their system. And of course, teams will agree that, you know, some days it doesn't work, but they won't come away from what they believe in, because they know over the course of a 38-game season, they'll win more often, or they'll win enough games to win leagues, as Jose used to do. So they don't panic. Whereas with United, it just looks a little bit off the cuff. And as I said before, when you get upward of 20 passes, there's no patience there. They won't come back out and keep going and going and waiting for the perfect gap, you know. Mm. Someone will try and force something. And that's what you want when you're the defending team and you're sitting in with 10 players behind the ball. You want them to force a pass because, well, that favours the defensive team, really.
Yeah, okay, very interesting. We'll be talking to Gary Breen later on about Arsenal, so I won't double up on that right now. There is a text in, by the way, from Ollie in Dublin. I see it's scoreless at the moment. Why are you laughing?
I know where this is going on.
No, right, it's now. Actually, it's not. It's not a Stephen Cluxton text. You'll be relieved to hear.
Okay.
We've saved that abuse for later on. We'll get you again on that. Brilliant. He says, I see it's scoreless between Brighton and Crystal Palace. Is it? Has it kicked off? Maybe that's why it's scoreless. Oh, has it? Okay. He says, can you ask Damien if the A23 is actually a derby, or is that media hype? The A23 derby.
Yeah, so it's about an hour to Brighton from Croydon. Which is where Crystal Palace is. It's a rival. I didn't know. I didn't know about. Say again.
That's not a derby.
Listen, I agree with geographically. Geographically, it's not. But if you ask the Crystal Palace fans, they genuinely dislike the Brighton fans, and I'm pretty sure there'll have been trouble at the game tonight. There is a genuine dislike. It goes back to the 80s. Something to do with someone stole a manager. I've heard several different stories, but because it's geographically not, like when I signed for Crystal Palace, you know, Charlton, Millwall, West Ham, but Millwall are kind of preoccupied with West Ham, whereas kind of the geographically closest team would be Millwall, but I think Millwall haven't got much interest in Palace really, because they're preoccupied with West Ham. So Charlton would kind of be the next one in, but for some reason, Brighton, the Crystal Palace fans have a genuine dislike of Brighton. And Brighton don't like Palace fans too much either. But it's the biggest game of the season for them. You ask any Crystal Palace fan, they will say it's the biggest game of the season for them.
Really? I'm trying to jog my memory here. I have a feeling we may have done a piece on this before. Was there a thing in Wembley recently or in one of the dressing rooms where someone took a dump?
That was Ian Holloway in the playoff semi-final.
Well, I'm not saying it was him that took a dump.
No. When we got to the Amex for the return leg, we drew 0-0 at Selhurst, and we got there. And when we got in the changing room, there was someone took a big dump in the middle of the kind of shower area. And when we went in, Ian Holloway just hit the roof and just was trying to fight some Brighton staff members. And sure, we were his players. I mean, that was Ollie. He was like that. He was eccentric. So we got cleaned up. It wasn't, didn't bother us. But Ollie made a big deal of it because he just wanted to, that's what he's like, you know what I mean? He wanted to cause a scene and everything. But we ended up winning that game anyway. So, yeah. There's some funny stories about how that turd actually came to be in our change.
I'm sure there are. Because Gus Poyet was the manager at the time, wasn't he? The opposition manager. Oh, yeah, okay. I've got it here. This is all coming back to me now. So Gus Poyet sent an angry email to all the employees and it leaked into the Sun because obviously if you're sending an email, what do you expect? He said, imagine having to write this email. For some reason that is still not clear to me, someone during the day had access to the away dressing room and done something terrible.
Yeah.
He says, and then he goes on to say it in clear English, someone had a poo all outside the toilets, over and around the toilets. I am angry that someone within this club would endanger our good name and stoop so low. Did they imagine it would affect the Crystal Palace players? Well, possibly it did. It fired them up. Somebody made a very bad decision.
Yeah, well, you know what? The word on the street, or what we were told afterwards, is it was our bus driver did it. we had a bus driver was called Jock at the time, and obviously the kit man goes out in the afternoon to set out all the jerseys and whatnot, and apparently he wasn't feeling very well, and while he was sitting on the toilet trying to do his business, he had the urge to vomit, and apparently he jumped off the toilet and vomited in the sink while continuing to soil himself. But then, out of panic, didn't tell anyone and apparently left the changing room. So when we got there was vomit and stuff. But Ollie hit the roof. He went into the tunnel at 7 o'clock and was trying to fight all the Brighton staff about the disrespect and everything. But we kind of had headphones on. Someone came in and cleaned it up, really. And that was that, really, if I'm being honest. Yeah. And we went on to win the game. So that's kind of the story behind it.
Right.
That night. But the other stuff, I'm not sure, man. I mean, I know.
I think there was a leg break back in the day from memory and it all kicked off as well. And things got a bit nasty. Yeah. I'm going to say, by the way, for legal reasons, this story about Jock may not be true. This is subject to confirmation.
Oh, 100%. It may not be true, but that's what we were told.
That's what we were told, okay.
That was the word on the campfire.
Well, what a moment to finish on. And the image that you've painted there is really
brilliant. Huh?
Yeah. Ideal. Perfect. Listen, thanks, Emil. Appreciate it.
Brilliant. All right.
Damon Delaney there. We'll take a short break.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Duff and Heskey.
Well, they're ticking along at Selhurst Park. It's Crystal Palace 0, Brighton 1. That's after 65 minutes on the clock there. Neil Mapai with the goal for Brighton. That was on the 45th minute. So Brighton thus far in the lead at Crystal Palace. Coming up on the football show this evening, we'll hear from Brian Kerr. He was at Old Trafford yesterday with Stephen Doyle. There was much to discuss there. And Gary Breen as well. He was at the Emirates with Nathan yesterday. So Gary Breen will be talking about Arsenal and the job that Mikel Arteta has on his hands. And Brian Kerr, I'm sure, touching on where Everton are as Carlo Ancelotti, it seems, although it's unconfirmed, was on Merseyside today for discussion. So it certainly seems like Arteta and Ancelotti appointments are imminent. In the meantime, Nathan Murphy was alongside Gary Breen at the Emirates yesterday. So he popped in earlier on today for a little chat about what happened yesterday in North London. Nathan Murphy, freshly back from the Emirates last night. Did you enjoy your trip?
Thoroughly enjoyed every trip to the Emirates. Okay. Football wasn't great from Arsenal's point of view. Manchester City, I thought, were good without having to be great. Mm-hmm. It's just a sort of forgettable enough game. I've covered a lot of Arsenal-Manchester City in the last couple of seasons, and it's only when you're doing your bit of research and you're going, why was that that? Yeah. Because Arsenal don't offer anything. No fight, no backbone, no real talent, no real atmosphere at the stadium. It's a very, very strange place to go at the moment.
Very quiet. Meanwhile, Mesut Ozil, who is routinely described as not having the stomach for a fight, any kind of halfway challenge, he does not want to know about it, and he walked very slowly off the pitch. Mm. I mean, even in just the most self-serving way, given what Xhaka did, I think he would just trot off the pitch at the moment so as not to create a storm. But Ozil, in fairness to him, has landed himself at the centre of something very high profile. On Friday, he tweeted a picture criticising the Chinese government for their treatment of Uyghur Muslims in China. He calls Uyghurs warriors who resist persecution. China's crackdown and silence of Muslims has been much discussed. The United Nations and various human rights groups estimate that between 1 million and 2 million people, mostly Uyghur Muslims, have been detained in dreadful conditions as part of what Beijing calls an anti-terrorism campaign. So Beijing argue that they are educating potential terrorists, whereas human rights groups say what's going on is abhorrent. So Ozil talked about how they burn their Qurans, they shut down their mosques, they ban their schools, they kill their holy men. The men are forced into camps, their families are forced to live with Chinese men, the women are forced to marry Chinese men, but Muslims are silent, they won't make a noise, they have abandoned them. Don't they know that giving consent for persecution is persecution itself? And this has kicked off a major reaction in China. A couple of months ago, the Houston Rockets general manager, Daryl Morey, tweeted in support of the protesters in Hong Kong, and all hell kicked off for the NBA. China, huge sponsor. Morey pretty quickly had to issue a grovelling apology. You can imagine the pressure he came under. And what's happened here is Ozil has put out this statement. The CCTV state television made the decision on Sunday to remove Arsenal's Premier League game. That's a big decision. And Arsenal could not rush quickly enough to distance themselves from any political comment. The content he expressed is entirely Ozil's personal opinion. The official account of Arsenal said on China's Twitter-like Weibo platform. So they didn't tweet it over here if you're looking for it. As a football club, they say, Arsenal always adheres to the principle of not being involved in politics. Although Miguel Delaney pointed out that Hector Bellerin said F Boris in a tweet and there's been no blowback. So where this leaves Ozil, we don't quite know. They're still selling jerseys, Arsenal jerseys, it was reported today over in China. But CCTV are pretty important to the Premier League. The deal with China is worth the guts of $700 million, I was reading today. So it's the largest overseas deal. That is $700 million of the $4.5 billion over 3 years, which goes on overseas deals. And China will not take this line down. So Ozil, whose position at the club always feels slightly precarious anyway,
he's on such a high wage, serious they trouble. Can't get rid of him.
Yeah. So I don't know, it's an interesting one for Arsenal because on the face of it, given what the United Nations have said and other human rights groups, reputable human rights groups are saying, what he's alleging has substance. Mm. He is talking as well about other Muslims being silent. I think every single Premier League club bar one has Muslims playing for it currently. I was just checking there, so who knows if other high-profile Muslim footballers started coming out and attacking China, what CCTV would do. You can't stop 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 players if they all start coming out. I mean, clubs can't do much about it. Mm. I suppose behind the scenes they might say, can you just keep this quiet?
I suspect there's a lot of scrambling going on behind the scenes. Reading this over the last couple of days, it feels like it's a massive story for the Premier League. The Premier League have been offering Arsenal support behind the scenes because suddenly a light has been shone upon China. The amount of money that which I'd imagine the Premier League are expecting their overseas rights deal to just climb and climb and climb, that if the Chinese state broadcaster suddenly decide, well, you know what, we're going to clamp down on what you may look at as a freedom of expression, but if you talk about our country, we're going to pull the plug instantly, it puts the Premier League and the clubs in a difficult position. Mm. Now, they're going to have to suck it up because they've taken these deals. They've taken the money. Mm. They know who they're dealing with. Mm. Ozil, obviously, you'd have to assume, was aware of what the potential was for this. Mm. It feels as though Arsenal are maybe just hoping it all just
completely goes away.
Down and
the Premier League may have to stand up to China here and say, look, we can't control what our players are saying. They're perfectly entitled to tweet this kind of stuff. They are going to tweet this stuff. I suspect others may follow Ozil now because this will garner huge attention and he's calling out other Muslims, high-profile Muslims, to say something about the situation. What can the Premier League do if various players take a stand over this and China says, you need to shut them up, otherwise we're pulling all the games? Like, from a Chinese perspective, they were able to pull the Arsenal City game. They can't pull every game. Or if they do, I mean, self-defeating as well in many respects.
Well, they can do. What is it, $700 million? It's the largest overseas deal. Yeah. $4.5 million the total overseas. Like the $4.5 billion. And the Premier League rights on this side of the world have very much stagnated. In fact, I think it was slightly down last time around. Yeah. But the overseas deal is just rising and rising. Whether they could have preempted this, I don't know. Do players receive advice? I don't think Mesut Ozil, if this is how he feels, he should be entitled to go and say it. But Miguel Delaney obviously points out there are contradictions there when it comes to Mesut Ozil.
He's good friends with Erdogan. So, yeah, Miguel Delaney made the point, you can't pick and choose morality, something that has, of course, been put to Pep Guardiola before regarding his speaking out against Spain and his refusal to do so with Abu Dhabi. So there's no doubt, like, Ozil is not a perfect person and he's open to that criticism of his friendship with Erdogan in Turkey. But that notwithstanding, he can make a very valid point about the situation in China. It's just amazing that China reacts so... Like, they've created it. Mesut Ozil's tweet would have come and gone, and a lot of us would have missed it. And now it's a huge story, and it's a huge issue for the Premier League. But this is like zero tolerance on China's part. And I
Who could have predicted that they would have clamped down on free speech?
I think they're buoyed by the way the NBA folded so quickly. I would think.
So they also, because the $700 million is coming from state TV, they probably rightly feel that that comes with a certain amount of power.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry said that Ozil has been deceived by fake news. It's fake news. So this is one to watch. I don't know where this is going to go. If Ozil keeps tweeting, if others start tweeting, what the Premier League response is going to be is the question. Arsenal's response is going to be, we're going to put our hands over our eyes right now and pray this goes away really
quickly. Say nothing.
Nezid, if you could, you know, just keep it shtum, that'd be great. But how do we say that to Mesut Ozil without him tweeting that? So that's one to watch over the next while. I think the Premier League might have to take the pain on this one. They can't set precedents whereby they bow down to China.
Well, what can they do? They can't suspend Mesut Ozil for this.
No. No, the issue is if China communicate to the Premier League,
we're
pulling the deal. In which case, the Premier League have to say, we're very sorry about that, but we can't silence 20 by 20, 400-odd players. So, that's Ozil. Not shirking it off the pitch. That's putting himself in the fire line in a big way. Man City were decent. Champions League draw.
Yeah, a tough one for Man City. Real Madrid.
Yeah.
Probably the standout tie of the round, though probably the best tie of the round will be Atletico Madrid against Liverpool.
I haven't seen much La Liga this year given the new TV situation, but Atletico rebuilding somewhat and they haven't had brilliant form domestically.
Or really in Europe. It's been a bit of a struggle at times. They were absolutely battered, I remember, in the first half of their game by Juventus and managed to somehow drag it out through a couple of corner kicks. João Félix is obviously the talent and the new wonder kid, but they don't seem quite as strong at the back as they were. Diego Godín's obviously not there, so there's a gaping hole. All you seem to read about Atletico Madrid is Kieran Trippier and his performances. It definitely doesn't feel like as tough a task going there for Liverpool as it would have been a couple of years ago. Yeah. And likewise, Manchester City, Real Madrid, they're very much in contention without feeling like they're anywhere near the side of 4 or 5 years ago. Midfield, every time I watched them and seen a good bit of them in the Champions League, like Modric has just dropped off ever so slightly. He still gets it ticking over, but maybe again it's that Ronaldo's not there and we all just don't fully appreciate how everything clicked. But Benzema's having one of the best seasons of his career. He's scoring almost a goal a game at this rate. But they're not the power they were either. And you really do look at it and think, like, Liverpool and Manchester City are a good step ahead of pretty much everybody else.
Feels that way. Chelsea have Bayern Munich. Bayern are fifth in the Bundesliga and their Inter manager may be still in place come February, may not. And then Spurs have Leipzig, which is a great draw for them.
Yeah, it's a brilliant draw. I did Leipzig a few times during the group stage and they're sort of the hipster choice, and Timo Werner does score a goal a game in the Bundesliga, but he's really struggled in the Champions League, and there's no huge quality outside of him. Emil Forsberg, the Swedish player, is sort of their other main threat. It's the sort of game you would expect Mourinho to absolutely relish. Borussia Dortmund, Paris Saint-Germain should be a decent game as well, but Paris Saint-Germain in midfield.
Yeah.
Since they brought in Icardi during the summer from Inter Milan, he's just been outstanding. Neymar's only back. They've rarely had Icardi, Mbappe, and Neymar on the pitch at the same time. But like, there's just a total lack of quality in midfield.
Mm. That's all in the future, Nathan. The time is now, and now belongs to big Duncan Ferguson.
Oof. Sure. See, we're such hypocrites.
Go on.
Like, it's been 6 months gone. Nah, United, they fell for the emotion of it.
Uh-huh.
Going with Solskjaer.
This is going to go if Ozil keeps tweeting, if others start tweeting. What the Premier League response is going to be is the question. Arsenal's response is going to be, we're going to put our... Moise did storm off, but if he's not at the pitch of the game, then you are entitled to take him off. The mistake is putting him on in the first place. You should have a reasonable grip on how, on where every player is and what's going to suit them in a game.
Well, also, you would think for a player like him who's clearly not starting, that you're working during the week on how he can make an impact and countering that issue of trying to get to the pace of the game, because he just looked light and he's not. Watched him that night against the Irish under-21s when he got sent off for the clash with Troy Parrott. He looked twice the size of the Irish 21s and he just pushed him off the ball every time he got it, like a big, strong player. And you watched him yesterday and you're thinking, who is this guy? Just didn't seem ready for any sort of physical contact, and every time the ball went near him, United players who, you know, there's questions about at times themselves, it was just way too easy.
Yeah.
So you would wonder how they haven't got into his head, when you come on for 15 minutes, this is what you got to do. Got to get yourself around, got to get a few big shoulders in, make an impact, unsettle them a little bit, and maybe you won't get your goal, but you'll do what we need you to do. Whereas he just looked totally unprepared.
Yeah. It was very interesting. His father a couple of months ago said it's a massive mistake him going to England. He said, we've made a terrible mistake here. We need to get him back to Italy as soon as possible. He's still just a boy. I don't think watching his 19-year-old son hauled off and ignored by the manager and going straight down the tunnel. Yeah, I would think January might be imminent for a return.
Part of the problem for him was he was brought in probably to be the main striker in that Dominic Calvert-Lewin's there. Again, a good player.
Yeah.
Strong physically. Never going to score 20 goals a season, though. That they sort of thought, because of what Juventus were doing financially, they might have just stolen this wonder kid away from them and he'd slot straight into the team and just never looked at it.
Yeah. Well, that was Manchester United yesterday. Gary Breen was on with you at the Emirates. We're going to hear from him just bemoaning how broken the Arsenal dressing room is. And Brian Kerr was at Old Trafford as well. So thoughts from him in conversation with Stephen Doyle. In the meantime, Nathan Murphy, thanks very much.
Sure, Joe.
There you are. That was Nathan Murphy speaking to us earlier on. In the meantime, a few bits to let you know about, including events between Crystal Palace and Brighton, 79 minutes in the clock. We mentioned that Brighton had gone 1-0 up in this game, and just in the last 4 or 5 minutes, Wilfred Zaha has scored an incredible goal. Just brilliant stuff. Inside the Brighton area, he was on the left-hand side of the penalty box. Lots of bodies around Brighton, plenty of men back. And he chopped the ball onto his left foot. He had really no angle on goal. He was a little bit wide. The only thing he could do was blast the ball high into the near post, and he managed to do that, and keeper had no chance to react. Just a brilliant goal. So Wilfred Zaha probably won't be at Crystal Palace much longer because he is of a different quality. So it's 1-1. Crystal Palace 1, Brighton 1, 79 minutes on the clock. As mentioned, Gary Breen up next.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Diouf and Heskey.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So Arsenal, Mikel Arteta was back home in Manchester late last night. Various members of the Arsenal hierarchy were seen leaving his house at about 20 past one in the morning or so, according to The Sun. There are photos, and he has now informed Manchester City he has been speaking to Arsenal. So that appointment is imminent or may have just happened. So Mikel Arteta and Arsenal seem like they're going to be spending some time together. Yesterday, we had Gary Breen at the Emirates. It was a desperately poor Arsenal performance. Mikel Arteta was watching alongside Pep Guardiola, and Gary Breen was in co-commentary for us, and we discussed the various ills of the Arsenal dressing room, which predate Emery and obviously will predate Mikel Arteta, and Gary Breen was very good in all this. So just to give you a sense of what he was saying about Arsenal and their problems and where they are and where they're going to go, have a listen to this. I first asked him here just at the end of the game, did he think that Arsenal improved in any way in the second half, or was it just a case of City 3-0 up at half time going into cruise control?
City just played within themselves, managed the game well enough, bearing in mind that they're going into the winter period, so they have to protect themselves as such. But no, I think that would be over-egging it a little bit to say that Arsenal were better in the second half. They were exactly what we saw in the first. It's just that City didn't put them to the sword, didn't feel that they had to.
Interesting full time is looking at Freddie Ljungberg, who wasn't all that active. I think you mentioned that as well.
I know.
Smiling with Guardiola, and in some respects there's something commendable and mature about having that kind of perspective, but you feel like what Arsenal need are a few people lacking in perspective, a few men possessed who are absolutely sick with that result. And Freddie Ljungberg, it's not an attack on him at all, and he had a long time to get used to the fact, I presume, that this result was going to go Man City's way. But you sort of want him to give a brief handshake with Guardiola and down the tunnel to tell that team what he thinks of their performances, and there's just not that culture in this squad.
No, there doesn't seem to be that culture at all at the whole club, and that's the problem. I was just discussing it with Nathan there in terms of, if you look up the goal that Pukki scores against Arsenal when he breaks for Norwich, that first goal, there's five defenders, maybe six defenders in and around them. He scores the goal. The camera then pans to Ljungberg on the bench next to Mertesacker and another coach. And they're sitting back, looking at the tablet, reviewing the goal. No one says a word. I've just said to Nathan, it was like they were in the cinema watching a film. And it was incredible. No reaction, no debate amongst them. No reaction of Ljungberg to get up and castrate his players or to demand why they weren't. And so passive. And that passive nature, because he's a lovely guy by all accounts, it's a reflection of his team. They're just so passive. And everyone will say, well, listen, he's only just come in. I still argue, listen, it's not all down to him. Of course it's not. And you need time to fix things. But you've got to be culpable in that you were part of Emery's coaching staff. So I don't understand it. Normally when an assistant gets the job, it's when the manager moves on, having been successful, in a way that they're saying Arteta potentially will do if Guardiola has another sabbatical and leaves City. But what were you hoping really to achieve in terms of getting a new voice? Because it's not a new voice. You're not going to get that bounce. And again, it just seems that the priority is just, can we get in an Arsenal man who's a brilliant footballer, which he was, an exceptional footballer, and will live long in the memory of these Arsenal supporters. But again, I keep saying it, I'm sick of saying it. It's a different remit.
Because if you think of coaching, I presume you would have experienced this. Really good coaching is not just one big team talk. It's a thousand small moments, like the concession of that goal you're talking about.
Yeah.
Someone's body position is off. Something could have been fixed.
It's a difficult one. I just feel that there's too many players now who lack an understanding in terms of how you can stop the opposition. I mean, we commented on it in terms of at the beginning of the game. For those goals that City scored, Arsenal had a back four, good distances between their midfield four, and then Ozil at 10, Aubameyang at the point. So if you took a picture of them, I'd be saying, yep, that's exactly where they've got to stand. But the problem is, as soon as City move the ball and you've got to make decisions and adjust your body and make a decision whether you go out, engage, whether you drop, your body shape, all that, they can't do it. And that's what's incredible, because this is Arsenal. I keep banging the drum. You're talking about the best defenders. You know, if you're picking a Premier League top defence, Arsenal's iconic one will be up there. Talking about top midfielders, Vieira, Petit will be up there, Gilberto Silva will be up there, and that's not even mentioning the likes of Henry and Bergkamp and them type of guys. So listen, they have fallen way below that. And the reality is now is that although these players are good individually, if you were to put them in a mid-table Premier League team, I'm not convinced they keep their place week in, week out.
I mean, it is amazing. They're ninth, 22 points after 17 games. And bar yep. Sheffield United, who may struggle to sustain this kind of form, Wolves can certainly keep things going. That puts Arsenal at about eighth. So they are now a mid-ranking team, really. And
yeah, but that's a reality, Joe. And that's what they need to do. I think to move forward, I think there needs to be a reality check to say, listen, stop banging the drum about we're this and we're that. Yeah, great history. But how many top clubs have had great history? It's about what you're doing on the pitch and... Yeah. They're so below that, it's frightening. It really is. And I take no pleasure in saying it.
No, I genuinely don't.
I really don't, because I'm desperate to see. And initially, when they had their issues, and I thought when Emery came on, I thought, and Emery first come to the club, I thought, yeah, brilliant. He's a manager who's going to introduce a bit of accountability in that. If you don't perform, you're not going to play. Ozil, we've seen how he done that. But slowly but surely, all that he tried to achieve engulfed him. And he just didn't know what to do. He didn't know whether to stick or twist. He was trying to play out from the back one week. The next week it was five at the back. Then it was four. This one was coming in. That one was coming in. And this is a manager who had a successful record. Yes, I know that the Premier League, and I always emphasise this. I think the Premier League asks questions of you. No other league does, in terms of you've got a competitive, tough game every single week. There's no gimme as such. And I just don't think that this Arsenal squad and the hierarchy, the lack of leadership there, we don't know who's making the decisions. We're talking about the fact that they had five captains, a captain group of five captains. I said to you before, if you have to have five captains, that means you ain't got one.
Do you know the interesting thing about the board? So that was a criticism you've regularly made, and it's undoubtedly a fair one. The interesting thing, though, when it comes to money, they have spent money. If you look at the lowest wage bill in the Premier League, that's Sheffield United on 13 million. The wage bill being traditionally the key indicator where you'll finish. Now, there are other underachievers. United are number one wage bill, and look where they are. But Arsenal, 101 million compared to Sheffield United's 13 million. They're the fourth highest wage bill in the league. They went and got Emery, on paper, a decent appointment. So I know money and spending money doesn't guarantee good decisions, but the board are trying to spend. Remember a couple of years ago under Wenger in the stadium time, they weren't spending money. They've actually started spending money a little bit of late, certainly to be doing better than they're doing, and they're just not making the right decisions with that money.
Well, exactly, and this is my point. Who's making the decisions? You know,
who's
part
of...
I couldn't tell you. I genuinely couldn't tell you, because it seems to change every month. There's always initially, a do comes in and he has played underneath Emery. So you're thinking, okay, they're building something. He wanted to get that chap from Rome. I can't think of his name. As someone who'd worked... that's it. He'd worked with Emery at Valencia and in Spain before. They couldn't get him in. So you're thinking, okay, now where are you going? But I keep emphasising, so much changes. Mislintat comes in and a great... When they initially brought him in, Casillas, I thought, oh, wow, that's a brilliant signing, bearing in mind all those brilliant players. And his nickname was Diamond Eye in terms of all those brilliant players he unearthed. So I thought, that's good, bearing in mind that Arsenal don't have the financial muscle. I know you're talking about the money they spent, but they don't have the financial muscle to compete with the likes of City. So I'm thinking, okay, develop your own players. It's a great place to come and play football. So people will want to come to the Premier League. They want to come to London. You can say it's a nonsense, but that's what they want to do. They want to live in London. So they have got all those things going in their favour. But then suddenly Mislintat goes because he's effectively not given a job that he was told. They had Maurice Volz, who was their German scout for 4 years as well. He leaves the club. Steve Bould gets reassigned to another job. It's always changing all the time. And then when you're hearing about Kroenke and his son coming in and saying, listen, Arsenal, we've made top class signings. They're not top class signings. And you can talk about £100 million spent on Pepe and Salibas, the young centre half from St Etienne. They loan him straight back. And I don't even think he's getting into their team at the moment. So you're thinking £30 million spent on what is potentially going to do it. And Pepe, we need to clarify this. They have not paid £70 million up front. They've paid it in instalments, and that's why they got the deal done. But you're looking at him and you're thinking, I'm not quite sure what he adds.
No. Diamond Eye. It's not the catchiest
Diamond Eye,
nickname.
That's it.
Not the catchiest nickname. Maybe the German translation's better, but anyway, he's gone. For people listening, Gary, who wouldn't have seen it, and they obviously remember the Xhaka situation, the Ozil substitution. You might just describe how petulant was this, how galling was this, how big a deal is this going to be in the morning?
Oh, well, listen, it will get legs, there's no doubt, and the Arsenal fans will be absolutely seething with it, bearing in mind that it's still so raw what Xhaka done. And they made a decision to take Ozil off, and he's been taken off under Lundberg before. And when he did it in previous games, he started shouting at Mertesacker on the bench. I mean, the lack of strength there as a manager to allow a player to do that to you is beyond me. But then anyway, the substitution's made. He's in around the halfway line. Arsenal, they're out of the game, but nevertheless, they want to make a positive substitution, want to chase it in the last few moments. He ambles off. Suddenly the boos start. He actually started walking slower. It looked like he was moonwalking at one stage. He was going backwards. And then he comes off and he volleys his gloves into the supporters, and you're just thinking, you just don't help yourself. And when you're talking about wage bills and stuff, that gives it a distorted one, doesn't it? That one of your players is getting £350,000 a week here, where he would not get that at any other club in the world.
Yeah, there's your highest earner.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I mean, you would think, even if you're Ozil, in a cynical way, just in a self-serving cynical way, you know what's happened to Xhaka a couple of months ago.
But on that, Joe, on that with Xhaka, and people think that they've just turned on the player, Arsenal were chasing the game. They needed to make a positive substitution, and he walked off Xhaka, and he got booed for it. Now, everyone says, and I understand that in terms of what he said, that he's found it difficult, that the horrible messages that his family have been getting, which is abhorrent. It really is. And that should have criminal proceedings if anyone's threatened his family. But take that aside, he has never, ever apologised for what he did that day in terms of swearing and telling the supporters to do one. He's just literally said an explanation as to why he did that. He feels no responsibility in terms of how he reacted, and nor did Ozil there. And this is the problem, is that they're the most self-rewarding group of players I think I've ever seen. I genuinely mean that, and they're the weakest group I've ever seen. You think about selfies when they beat Leicester that time here, that late Danny Welbeck winner to beat them 2-1 in the season that Leicester won the league. And they thought they'd won the league. Selfies in the changing room, celebrating, jumping around, literally had the champagne out. Ended up finished 10 points behind Leicester. And this is the problem you have, is that there's a culture at Arsenal that's rotten. It is. And that's not to say they're not great guys and they're not good footballers, because they are. But as a collective, it's rotten. It really is.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Geoffrey Heskey.
Stephen Doyle here with Brian Kerr after a pretty exciting game here at Old Trafford. Brian, Manchester United won, Everton won. I think you thought it was a pretty fair result in the end.
I thought it was a fair result, but I thought it was a very good game. It was mostly all out attack by both teams. Certainly United's approach was along those lines. They played with the same vibrancy and dash that we've seen in the recent matches. Obviously, the win over Spurs and Manchester City, they were very good in both games. We pair of us saw them at Sheffield United, and it was only sporadic that we saw that type of play, that spell in the second half when they got three goals and 11-minute spell to get into a lead. But today, I thought United were very good at times. So unfortunate to lose the goal, which gave Everton something to hang on to, and they nearly did. And then when they conceded the equaliser, they had to go to try and win the match themselves. But a good match, and I think both managers will, to use the phrase that's most common now with managers, take positives from the game. I think both managers will take lots of positives from that game.
Well, one man that's oozing positivity at the moment is Mason Greenwood. I know you're a big fan of his, and he is getting crucial goals now for Manchester United. When you look at the likes of Martial and possibly Jesse Lingard as well, maybe not playing that well at the moment, how long before he starts pushing for a starting place in this United team? Or is 18 years of age, is he still a bit too young?
I don't see him being a regular ahead. I mean, I feel that the front line, Daniel James, Rashford and Martial, is actually playing very well at the moment. I mean, I think Lingard has been a little bit less so. He's not been a regular. He's not been getting his game. He's had his problems this season. But in recent matches, when he came on against Sheffield United, he had a big impact on the match. Played well here, I thought, against Villa too. And then he made good contribution last week at Manchester City and in the Spurs game. So I think Lingard's been doing all right. But with a C Greenwood start, I see him much like Rashford when he came in as a young lad. Not he got the physical strength to play as the main man centre forward as he would have as a youth player. Forced to play wide, similar to Rashford and Martial when they came in, when Lukaku was here. Alexis Sanchez was here, they're squeezed out a bit more. Now this year, Lukaku and Sanchez are gone. So Martial and Rashford are in the team. Martial playing in his position. Probably his best position. I have a feeling he might like playing with somebody else up front. But I don't see Greenwood being, you know, taking any of those players' places in the immediate term. But, you know, there'll always be opportunities because of fitness issues, there may be even suspensions, injuries, all sorts of things. So he's a very good squad player, and having an impact coming on in big matches, not just the Europa League, where United have been much better than Astana, Partizan and AZ in general, although they lost to Astana, and they lost away to, but yeah, in general they've been better than those teams. Whereas the Premier League, the matches are much more even. He's made an impact, he scored a couple of goals. When you say I like him, I like his mentality and his technical ability to be able to go in at 18 years of age into a Premier League in the heat of battle, away to Sheffield United, Bramall Lane, raucous Bramall Lane that day, get a goal. And then come on today when the rest were struggling to find a way to score, and he scored, and it wasn't an easy chance.
Yeah, it was a great finish. Just on United, Victor Lindelof, there was a quote from him a couple of weeks ago saying that their problem was that they were really switched on for the big games against the likes of, say, Man City last week, Tottenham the week before, but it was against the weaker sides in the division that they really just weren't being switched on enough, and they weren't focused enough on those games. You know, is this United season? Are they just going to be, you know, stuttering from one good result to another kind of average result and just hovering around that 7th, 8th position, or maybe up to 6th, 5th,
well,
not getting into the top four?
We don't know. I mean, I think it's definitely an improvement in recent weeks. The last match they've lost was away to Bournemouth when they played quite poorly, but they were after them on a fair run before that, and since then the results have been good. I mean, I was here when they beat Brighton 3-1, and they played very well indeed. Then we had the two draws with Sheffield United and Aston Villa, which were frustrating for them, given both of those were teams that come up from the Championship last year. But Sheffield United are proving their mettle week in, week out, and Villa looked a half decent side here, I have to say, in that game. Since then, beating Spurs, beating Manchester City, and fair enough draw today. I mean, Everton didn't come here to lie down. They've had a little bit of a surge now with Duncan Ferguson in at the moment, coming off a good result. So that's fair. What's that? Three wins and three draws from the last six games, which is not bad. It's
twelve
points from 8 in, and while they're combining the Europa League matches, but you know the Christmas matches will tell a tale. You've got four games tied together. League games, busy schedule, and they've not got the most difficult programme over that time. So, you know, I think there's a bit more consistency about. If you look at the team, it's become more stable looking. The team today was the same team as last week. You look at centre halves, that's the partnership that's playing regularly. You look at the midfield, and it's the same partnership. Fred McTominay has settled into, still no Pogba available to them, few other players out injured, but some of them are probably available. Jones is probably available, and he won't get into the team after his performance against Sheffield United, the likes of Rojo. But he's definitely gone towards the younger group. It appears that's what the club want. That's what the policy is, a younger profile. They're the youngest team in the league on a regular basis, average age just around the 25 years mark. They had the youngest team that ever played in the Premier League against Brighton a few weeks ago. So, you know, that's where the action is for them. And he is taking them along that road. We talked about the pressure now that Pochettino was available after the Sheffield United game. And we talked about it again after the Aston Villa game. But that's quieting down a little bit now after the last week. But certainly the style of football today, there's nobody left this ground saying, we need to go back to the old style and the Fergie style and all that. People who were here today were entertained. They saw a youthful team playing with verve and vim and attacking quality and intent. That's what I saw. And they took risks in chasing the equaliser and in chasing the winner.
Just ask you quickly before I ask you about Seamus Coleman. If they were going to sign anybody in January, what area of the pitch? Like, I'm kind of looking at that United team, possibly a central midfield. They could do with signing somebody in there, maybe.
Well, if Pogba goes, I mean, there was talk about Pogba going before, you know, that he wanted to go.
Well, that's an offer, because he's got this ankle injury, but he's been playing basketball down in America.
Well, it does seem odd that he hasn't been around and that they're allowing him to get treatment far, far away. I would have thought that Manchester United would have a very strong team of physios and medical people here that could treat, that have seen it all before. It seems very strange that they would allow one of the most
valuable assets,
a very phrase, to float about and do his own thing many miles from Manchester. That seems odd, but you know, I think we will see. Well, we have to presume we will see him back in the United team before the end of this season, and then evaluate whether they need another midfield player. I think Fred has settled down into a much more effective player than what we saw in the early part of this season and last season. And McTominay has become such a key man. Did they need another player in there? Of course they would need another player that would add to that. But at the moment, I think the pair of them are doing quite well. Mm. And if they had Pogba, would give them another option. He lacks consistency, but maybe within this team, I mean, it appears they've got back some of the values that most people thought were very important to Manchester United, you know, Pogba doesn't always fit with that, I would say, you know, when you be talking about a lack of bling and humility and a team player and low key and professionalism and get on with it. You know, he doesn't really sit in with those. He's exuberant and he's extravagant and he's, you know, he's got different coloured hair and he's very much bling and extrovert. But, you know, with those guys, if they can deliver for you in the match and do their stuff and they're exceptional and they produce and they're match winners, and that's what he needs to do. He needs to come back. He owes them one now because he's done nothing for months. He hasn't played. You want to come back here and do your stuff and get on with it.
Brian, I'm going to reveal some news to you because I've just been talking to Seamus Coleman, the Irish captain, down in the tunnel there. And on the day of his 300th Everton appearance, which really is a fantastic record, he told us that he actually played with that rib injury that he's been out with for the last few weeks, called upon obviously because the fact that Sidibe was down with an illness. That kind of epitomises the kind of player that Seamus Coleman has been over those 300 appearances for Everton, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's no surprise really to hear that. I mean, I don't, you know, he's obviously had something that's kept him out of the group for the last few weeks. He wasn't on the bench. I mean, I think he had lost his place based on performances. He hadn't been playing that well. He was part of the defence that was getting ripped apart, and the manager was sacked as a result. But, you know, fair play to him getting out and play today. Everton supporters love him. He's highly respected in the club. He's highly respected in Ireland. He's a sensational lad.
Is he one of the best Irish players we've seen in the Premier League? Where would he rank, do you think, in that maybe top five, top ten?
Take me a bit of time to assess that. He's playing in an era in the Premier League where we have had very few other Irish players playing in the Premier League. That's the truth of it. This year has been a bit different since Sheffield United come up, and we had four if you include Callum Robinson, who are nearly regulars in the Sheffield United team. And outside that, those players and the Borney players, the three at Borney who have been, you know, Kevin Long is not playing regular, Jeff Hendrick is playing regular, Brady has not been playing right. We had Stephen Ward when he was there, but they were there. They've been our Premier League players for the last, well, 6-7 years. We haven't had anyone else who has been playing on a regular basis. Yeah. So Seamus has probably been the best in that era. But over the whole Premier League era, I'd have to evaluate that because we've had a lot of decent players over that time in the Premier League. It's just that in recent times we haven't had Irish players good enough to get consistent places in near the upper echelons of the Premier League.
He did say that Duncan Ferguson gave a very inspirational speech to the players before they kicked off the game today. Look, would there be any harm in just letting him take the tiller for the next few games, and maybe Everton, Mashiri and Kenroy's up in the director's box, maybe just to take their time and to assess what the club needs? I don't know if Ancelotti's the right man. Is he really for Everton at this moment in time?
Well, there's no one in Everton telling us they're dealing with they're talking to Ancelotti anyway, so we don't know if that's the case. Mm. Duncan Ferguson won, you know, in the space of a very short time, they've got two very good results where they're coming off the back of what's been a poor season. They had them down near the bottom three and, you know, coming off three defeats in a row, Norwich, Leicester, hiding off Liverpool in the derby match. Now they've got 4 points, which brings a little bit of hope and stability. But we've seen all this before with Everton. They've had more managers in the last few years than the most clubs around, chopping and changing and bringing in new managers halfway through the season to rescue a situation where they thought they were going to have a good season. I wouldn't be surprised, given that the two performances and the two results, if they left Ferguson there for a while longer to see how it pans out, while they identify what they consider to be the right man. They haven't been very good at picking managers.
Well, it seems that Moshiri seems to, because he's got such a control of the club now with regards to his shares and that kind of thing, he's got the main shareholder there now. He seems to want control of the decision, which he did with Marco Silva, and you know, maybe that wasn't the right decision. Well, it wasn't the right decision, as we found out.
You know, they had Sam Allardyce, and Sam got them results and got them up to a very respectable finish last year. Was it 10th or 8th last year, or 2 years ago? And they weren't happy with that, you know. And they identified Ronald Koeman before that, and it didn't work out with him either. So they've had a bit of a succession of people that hasn't worked out with either. So I don't think they've been very good at picking what they really, really want.
Yeah.
You know, which is, they seem to want someone that understands the history of Everton and the type of game that Everton fans like, and who can get them results playing that way. So, you know, I don't know what way they're going. But for the time being, they've got themselves out of the mire a little bit by the two results. And let's see how it goes over the four games. It's been difficult for them because so many players out injured. So many. When you look at the team today, and Sidibe, I think, would have started. You, I think, would agree. Sigurdsson and Snyderlin would have played in the middle of the field had they been fit and well. Theo Walcott would probably have started as well, but then you're looking at other ones outside of that group. Gamien, I think the lad they signed expensively pre-season, he's hardly played at all. You know, there's a lot of players there. Gomez, who was their best midfield player, he's out of the picture. You know what I mean? He's just back from an injury as well. And they've had a lot of problems. So fair play to them getting results with the team they had out today, with the two young lads in the middle of the field, Holgate and Davies, who did very well, I thought.
Thanks, Brian.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diouf and Heskey.